going to be doing the events for us and all sorts of. Hello, Stephen. Hold on, I didn't turn your mic on. No one heard you, Steve.
Hey, how are we doing, Bill?
Yeah, we're doing wonderful. I'm glad you had a wonderful time with your family.
Yeah, good, nice to be back, though.
It is. And then I'm also pleased to have kind of a principle for the first year's story that we're telling about traditional ecological knowledge, Native American culture, and Indian Native American genocide. I have Allie Meadows Knight, the Butte Environmental Council Environmentalist of the Year and Minchupta Tribe member in the studio. Hi, Allie.
Hello.
Hey, Tunani. Love that. Hey, Tunani. I absolutely love that. So what we decided to do is I thought it would be a perfect time to kind of have Allie give us 60, 90 seconds about, a little bit about the event that they had up there. So then when we kind of jump into Don Hankins and the rest of the pre-records, they got a little bit of context. So what do we got for our listeners, Allie?
Oh, yes. It was at the Butte Creek Ecological Reserve.
It's hard to say.
I know, I want to say, but I want to say, you said environmental, and I just can't get it out of my mouth.
That's okay.
But, so the Butte Creek Ecological Reserve, there's two of them. There's a preserve and the reserve. They're both run by Chico State. Don Hankins also works on both pieces of property. And so I was able to work out at the reserve out off of Highway 32 before you get to Forest Ranch for many years, doing field trips with kids and also being able to learn traditional burning and with Don Hankins, who was learning not only from his Miwok and local traditional culture, because he is native Miwok, but he also was learning from Aboriginals in taking sabbaticals to Australia. So there was a lot of indigenous knowledge being learned.
Yeah.
So for years, he'd been doing fire regimes up there. And so this last trip was actually going out and do field trips to work with specialists and understanding how those fire regimes worked before and after. What we see as far as fire as a tool,
mm-hmm.
and not only prescribed burnings, but traditional burns.
Excellent. And so what you're going to be hearing here was, for a storyteller, I couldn't have had a better venue than the Butte Creek Ecological Reserve. In that quick backstory, I asked Don, he said, I want to do a quick little prompt question. He said, well, I'm going out on a tour. You might ask me questions then. I was like, oh, my God. So I was out there with a field recorder. Shout out to my dear friend, Stephen Ross Brandon, who is kind of like my assistant holding the umbrella during the rain. But Don led one of three different tours. And what we're going to be playing tonight is a wonderful mix of not just Don Hankins talking about the traditional ecological knowledge and the land, but the folks on the tour as well. So I'm really excited about this. And I'm really excited to have Allie in the studio and my dear friend Steven. So we're going to play these, and Allie, and, she's going to kind of go, let's stop on that one and me say something. So it's going to be kind of fun. Even you too, Steven. Even you, if you got something to say. I know you do.
Steven.
Yeah. What do you got to say right now before we start this?
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year, everybody.
It's going to be a rowdy year, but a lot of fun.
All right, no further ado here on People Power Radio.
It's burning hot, and it's not saying you're burning 100,000 acres. The intent is to burn a small area, but at a higher severity that then will regenerate with the right kind of fire that you're now setting to help it to heal, right? So Australia all around it right now, if you've looked at any of the fire maps, is on fire. Even the area where I work in the north is on fire, which... they've done their burning out there this year, but there are areas where their fires didn't get to. So it's a balance between where they burned and where these wildfires are happening. But in the south, like Sydney area and the Blue Mountains, this idea of doing this type of burning is just now starting to take off. And there's a lot of interest to try to bring, and there are Aboriginal groups that are working on bringing fire back into those areas. But it's just not at the scale where it's going to make a difference at this point. And unfortunately, we're seeing the damages that are happening because of that.
Yeah.
So I think more and more people are going to jump on board with the idea of doing indigenous burning in Australia. They're probably going to be a little more progressive at it than we are here. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a huge opportunity for that to then pollinate what we're trying to achieve here, between North America, in the U.S., Canada, and even some groups in Mexico, mm-hmm. to be able to do this kind of work. So,
one quick question I had, Don, because it's been really some of the funner audio bites I've got, is just talking about how, enamored you've been since a little kid to teach the subject. Mm-hmm. And some of the spots you talk, we actually talked to one of your students, mm-hmm. that was out on a burn. Maybe you could fill our listeners in a little bit about your teaching background, how important that is to you and your work.
You know, to be honest, like, I never wanted to become a teacher, per se. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, I wanted to be a land manager. Like, mm-hmm. that's what directed me to go to grad school and do what I have done. But I ended up at the university, and I thought I'd give it a try. So one of the nice things about it is that I get the opportunity to talk not only to my students and teach them, but to groups like this and others, you know, mm-hmm. to hopefully make the change that needs to happen in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully you have a good listening audience, and, you know, they'll be the next part of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you, Don.
Mm-hmm. For a while, I'm Firefighter 2. I have a burn boss qualifications in Australia under the Australian system, which is not recognized in the United States, even though if you look at the language side by side, it's exact as RXB2 here in California or under NWCG. But CAL FIRE and the federal agencies don't recognize that. But what I think is more powerful and what I'm really trying to shift for, particularly for tribal communities, is a different standard that's based off of cultural knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I burn on two continents, and with Aboriginal communities in Australia, in desert ecosystems, in the tropics. I have responsibilities to those areas and my own responsibilities to place here. And that's been with me through my entire, like, development, right?
So do you think you're going to go for the California new burn boss program, or do you feel the need to do that?
Well, so that's one thing that the reserves is kind of pressuring, that they want to have more control over the opportunities to burn, when and how we burn. And so now they're saying, well, like, we want you to do this. And part of me is like, I don't need it.
No, I can understand.
Right? But at the same time, if it can help here and it can help what we're trying to do within the community, you know, we've got 36,000 acres of planning between three watersheds here, that if we can help to facilitate that in a way, then maybe it's worth it in that regard. But is it necessary? No. And that's the thing I think is really important, is that, you know, as you learn to burn and you get more experience in burning, and you have that confidence, then you understand what your own abilities are. And do I need to go out and fight wildfires? No. You know, and I think that's one of the problems in some respects with the trainings, mm-hmm. is that while I recognize the role of that, what we're doing is so different than that. And the approach to come in with an understanding of suppression first, mm-hmm. I think we need to retool everybody to have a different set of team where it's learn to burn in this way first. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because you're almost being trained that it's going to go out of control. Therefore, you got to learn how to suppress it.
Yeah.
When all you want to do is burn in a natural way, which is not going to be out of control because you are in control.
Yeah. And it doesn't say that discount that you need to know how to do suppression, right? Like, you should know how to put something out, and you should know how to read the indicators of now is not a good time to burn, right?
Absolutely.
And that's one of the things when... Like, when Shannon comes in a little bit and starts talking about permitting and regulations from CAL FIRE standpoint, one of the things she shared with me last week is that she's afraid that this workshop is going to encourage people to go out and burn.
Isn't that
right? But I don't say that to dismiss any of her concerns, but I think nobody, I don't think, would be that foolish to just jump out and think, I've gone to a workshop and I'm good to go. You know, it's, you got to build.
That's my language too. I say, I'm not offering a training, I'm offering a workshop.
Yeah.
An educational experience.
Right.
So hooray for DIY.
Right. 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 Yeah.
Because you've referenced it a moment, I'm curious what your take on the wildfire in Australia is currently, and how that relates to, because I heard you in another talk about working with Aboriginal folks down there, where there was a particular area that they were like, we're not even going to do a spot controlled action here. We're just going to burn everything because it's just such a mess.
Yeah.
And how does that relate to, like, what's actually happening down there right now?
So what you're referring to, the latter part there, is the ecological reset, right?
Yeah.
So the ecologic reset is a wildfire, and there's a cultural prescription for when to reset a community, right? So if you understand the parameters of environment, you read it, and you know this is totally unhealthy, and the only way to fix it is to burn it hot. And it's not saying you're burning 100,000 acres. You know, the intent is to burn a small area, but at a higher severity that then will regenerate with the right kind of fire that you're now setting to help it to heal, right? So Australia, all around it right now, if you've looked at any of the fire maps, is on fire. Even the area where I work in the north is on fire. which, you know, they've done their burning out there this year, but there are areas where their fires didn't get to. So it's a balance between where they burned and where these wildfires are happening. But in the south, like Sydney area and the Blue Mountains, this idea of doing this type of burning is just now starting to take off. And there's a lot of interest to try to bring, and there are Aboriginal groups that are working on bringing fire back into those areas. But it's just not at the scale where it's going to be make a difference at this point. And unfortunately, you know, we're seeing the damages that are happening because of that. Yeah. So I think more and more people are going to jump on board with the idea of doing Indigenous burning in Australia. They're probably going to be a little more progressive at it than we are here. But I think there's a huge opportunity for that to then pollinate what we're trying to achieve here, you know, between North America, in the U.S., Canada, and even some groups in Mexico to be able to do this kind of work. So,
one quick question I had, Don, because it's been really some of the funner audio bites I've got, is just talking about how, you know, enamored you've been since a little kid to teach the subject. And some of the spots you talked, we actually talked to one of your students that was out on a burn. Maybe you could fill our listeners in a little bit about your teaching background, how important that is to you and your work.
You know, to be honest, like, I never wanted to become a teacher, per se. Like, for me, I wanted to be a land manager. Like, that's what directed me to go to grad school and do what I have done. But I ended up at the university, and I thought I'd give it a try. So one of the nice things about it is that I get the opportunity to talk not only to my students and teach them, but to groups like this and others, you know, to hopefully make the change that needs to happen in the world, right? So hopefully you have a good listening audience, and, you know, they'll be the next part of that, right? Yeah.
Thank you, Don.
All right, Gamma Mash. I did think some of that did repeat. You know, I think I've got this, like, Zara radio, like, devil and something going on. Like, the last minute of that played twice. But anyway, Ali Mander's got some things she wants to say around what Don just talked about.
Well, yeah, he was talking about basically burn boss certification that he had in Australia and wasn't able to transfer those credentials into California or even into the United States, even though if you match their language of certifications, they match. And they went in further about there's a difference between, say, a prescribed burn that you'll see from Cal Fire, something you'll be trained to do, which is more or less still around fire suppression. And then what we're having is also doing traditional burns. And something that I learned picking up when I was over at this event was listening to someone talk about actual prescribed burns done here in Butte County by fire folks who actually do not understand traditional burns and the cycles of them. So there is just also a misunderstanding without traditional knowledge of burns, like he had mentioned, where there's a subscription to or prescription to reset the ecosystem because it's damaged and it needs to start over again. That is a prescription. Right. And a lot of times Cal Fire, what we've seen from untrained folks who either know suppression, they also only know scorched earth hot burns. So when they do a prescribed burn, they high-five each other knowing that they brought it down scorched earth. They treat it like a war. And I think this is where I'm supporting, especially going into to applying for the 2018 Farm Bill, that's application is opening up in August for federal lands, especially BLM lands and federal lands for management, especially fire management that needs to be done. Let me repeat, close to 85 to 90% of our wildfires start in federal lands. So we're looking at over 100,000 acres here in Butte County that need to be managed. So I just want to reinforce the fact that having tribes lead the way on the certification for traditional burning and for prescribed burning is necessary. And Cal Fire and United States really need to acclimate and acculturate themselves into this type of understanding of land management, or we're going to be in the same spot Australia is right now, where no matter how much effort they're going to put into it, it will just not be enough.
It won't. And my good friend Stephen Ross Brandon is listening from Oklahoma. I talked to him on the phone. He said those fires are going to burn for at least a couple more months, right, in Australia. You got anything to add before we toss in some underwriters, Steve Marquardt?
Just don't go anywhere if you're listening right now. You know, we've got a hell of a program coming up and a lot of knowledge to be shared, so stay tuned. All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and roll into the folks who support this program, and that is Youth for Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state and local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts have been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and spreading the word out about arts and culture through their bi-monthly newsletters. To stay in the know about the arts or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art and stay in touch. And by Chico Paper Company, a family-owned cornerstone of downtown Chico for over 40 years, located at 4th and Broadway. Chico Paper Company features an on-site custom framing studio and art gallery showing the largest selection of local and regional artists. Chico Paper Company can be reached by calling 891-0900 or at chicopapercompany.com.
All right, it's kind of fun because we're going to transition to back to Don Hinkins, but he kind of carries on and about, you know, bringing some students out to do a burn, and we're going to be hearing a little bit from Henry Schleiger, who's actually running from Butte County Board of Supervisors here on People Power Radio.
Kind of cooler fall day, and we had a burn window, and I had a class of students out here, and, you know, none of them are trained as wildland firefighters. I just got the opportunity to bring them out, and we needed to get some burning done. So we started out up at the headquarters, and we worked our way down the road, and we lit fires along the way. And this was one of those burns where it was like, hey, it's a perfect opportunity, and let's burn it. And, you know, it was burned off in about 15 minutes, and once it cooled down and the smokes were out, we moved on to the next spot. But we probably did, I don't know, 30 acres that afternoon just with students and, you know, some backpack sprayers and simple tools. And, yeah, it's really good way of doing it.
Documentation of the native use of this area, because that's where I would go.
Right. Yeah, no, not so much. But you're keying in on things that I key in on, right? So we're looking at different mushrooms, and there's all in the springtime. This is covered in geophytes, so lots of different bulb plants and whatnot out here.
What was the response from your students, Don, since they're not here to answer for that wonderful experience? Were they excited? Were they?
I don't know. Henry, are you around somewhere?
One of the students is here. Look at that.
Where'd he go? Henry, were you here the day we burned this?
I think so, yeah.
There you go, Henry.
What was your experience,
What was my experience burning this? Well, I mean, we did this, from what I remember, it was a pretty low-intensity burn. You know, just basically just burning the grass off. It's, I mean, burning anything is fun, but, you know, burning under those conditions, it's frankly, it's easy. You know, you light it, you watch it, you see it move, make sure it's not moving too fast. That's about what there is to it. It's great. It's so much happens so fast. You know, I mean, it's the chemical reaction that is just taking over, and it just takes a spark. You know, if you do it under the right conditions, it's not scary. It's not, you know, it's not really dangerous at all. Mm-hmm. It's just fun. And
yeah. You look excited.
So. Good results. Oh yeah. Hell yeah.
Results,
I'm always happy to light.
One thing I think that Henry, didn't mention is that I tend to, usually look for the student who's most afraid of fire. So I heard you say
that you're a little bit afraid of fire.
So my typical approach on this, and this is not necessarily everybody else's approach, but you know, there's one thing that's often said about fire is that if you want to make people believers in fire, you got to give them the torch. Mm-hmm. And so I find the person who's most afraid of fire and ask them if they would like to carry the torch with me that day, and I'll show them how to light. And by the end of the day, they almost become pyromaniac if they haven't, you know. That's the best way to learn to burn, right?
I'm scared that it would be too easy and too much fun, and then I'd regret what I did later on after I burned into a neighbor's property or something.
No, that's why you don't want to get overly aggressive with the fire, right? Just a little bit here and there, and knowing how to burn off this section. So like on this one, the road wraps around the top of it. We've got a deer trail on the downward slope of the other side, and then it shifts into a shrub community. It's pretty much contained by the deer trail. So we used the top of the road and the deer trail and brought the fire around this way to really allow, actually, we were trying to build some heat to sweep up underneath this oak. And so we kind of wrapped it and then let the fire consume the hill slope in that one.
All right, back in the studio. Allie's going to pick up a little bit and kind of help our listeners understand why we need to be afraid of fire in the hands of people that know what they're doing.
You know, it's a little decolonization, and it's also re-educating and reacquainting ourselves with truth and justice, environmental justice and ecology. So when we were looking about what Smokey the Bear was, the worst thing that could have ever happened to our forests,
yeah,
because it was strictly and only fire suppression, and only you could prevent a forest fire. Well, that was really based on some very primitive, undeveloped, unknowledgeable, observation of a landscape that had actually just recently been colonized. So when we talk about fear of fire, I believe that one is that it was produced as we're young kids by Smokey the Bear in videos and whatnot. So that needs to be unlearned and the brain retrained. And second is to understand that for thousands of years, fire has been used as a tool here. We cannot take a time machine back into time and change and suppress thousands of years of fire to acquaint ourselves to what we want today.
Mm-hmm.
What we have to do is acclimate ourselves and really create adaptation for ourselves and our own society, that this is a fire community, always has been for thousands of years, that cannot be undone. So the fear of fire in this area is definitely... it needs to be dealt with, and I believe that Don has a great approach. I myself have the same approach working with Paradise High School, working with students up in Paradise, high school students, getting them reacquainted with Don Hankins on getting some prescribed burn not only done up in Paradise, but actually on the Paradise High School campus, so that students can actually have these tools right there on campus and see how they work. So this portion of using, carrying the torch when you have fear of it is quite brilliant, because there's no other way to face your fear other than to just hold it in your hand and walk with it. So I believe that everybody in this community has to face that fear and conquer it in order for us to all survive together.
Perfect. I can't possibly segue. I always kind of get a joy out of producing these shows, the nonlinear aspects. So now we're actually going to go back to the very beginning of the walk. I put these out of order for reasons to tell a story. But the next three are going to be right in order as we walk. You're going to hear people huffing and puffing a little bit, going up and down the hills. But the first place Don stops is pretty, but it's only like a couple of minute walk down. And then he starts talking about native grasses. And if there's anyone that could talk about native grass and how to bring it back, it's Don Hankins here on People Power Radio.
Almost every single year in the last 12 years. And so what's really awesome about it is that it started out being almost entirely covered in sar thistle, and now we've got probably at least a half dozen native species of grasses that are part of it, including the deer grass and the creeping wild rye and the blue wild rye and the purple needle grass there next to Susie. That's our state grass, for those of you who don't know it. It's been maintained by fire, and the fire really helps it out. So I think it's really amazing thing to see, you know, a place when I talk about how rare native grasses are as a grassland ecosystem in California with like less than 1% remaining. Well, here's a place where you can actually see what it actually looks like. Yeah.
And did you spread any seed here?
There has been a little bit of that. So, you know, being that it was covered entirely with star thistle, and anywhere that I'm talking about initially putting fire in on this little walk that we're doing today, our first indicator of why we wanted to put fire in somewhere was usually there was like one or two native grass culms that were sticking up in the field to like all star thistle. And so we said, okay, well, if there's a few of those native plants in there, we're going to run fire, and then those grasses are going to increase, and we're just going to continue to manage for those natives. So yeah, so the creeping wild rye that's all bent down over here, that all came in as a seed stock, or not a seed stock, a root stock, because up in this area of California, the seeds themselves are not viable. Only down in the Delta area, the seed's viable. So we brought seed in, and the grass itself then spread. But
why is that?
I don't know why. Just genetically, they just don't produce viable seeds. So they prefer, I guess, well, the only way that they reproduce is vegetatively.
Is this Carex barbari?
No. This is the lamus up here.
Lamus.
Yeah.
Tetrachoides.
So, yeah.
So you imported a little bit of seedlings, basically, and you transplanted them and let them go from there.
Yeah. Yeah. But most everything else was either in the seed bank or, kind of expanded upon by adding a few seeds here and there. So once the seeds are ripe on the plants, you know, that we've seen come back in, we tend to come back in, grab seeds, store them in the fridge, you know, over the summer. And then in the wintertime after we've burned, we'll broadcast them back out just to increase it. The only place I can think right behind us here that you can see some blue wild rye and some purple needlegrass right on that corner, that area was all done with plugs. But we found that generally plugs are not as successful as just doing broadcast seeding out here.
So and those seeds don't like to burn.
What's that?
You're saying the seeds don't like to burn. You take them off before you burn.
We generally do, but that's one thing that's kind of nice about the native grasses is that even if they've retained the seed, once the fire passes through, the culm, usually with a low-intensity fire, the culm burns at the base, and then the culm falls over, and then it self-seeds out some distance from the parent plant. Mm-hmm. So they do a really nice job of doing that. I just want to stop and talk about this, you know, in that particular spot, and we'll continue on.
Tried to burn this area every year?
Every year it's had fire on it. Not always successful. In a wet year like this one, we may only get a few of the plants to burn. Those deer grass get burned quite a bit, though. As soon as the detritus builds up around the base of them, we can run fire in it pretty much springtime, wintertime, you know, whenever we get the opportunity. Mow burn meadow, and I should say everything that's on our right side as we're walking along all was part of that 70 acre burn that was done 2 weeks after the campfire last year. So everything that's basically exposed anyways, at least they tried to put fire on it. Doesn't mean that it burned. They tried to put fire on it. So we call this the mow burn meadow because we're doing a little bit of experimentation, looking at not only just fire itself, but how other sorts of things as fire surrogates help to reduce invasive species. But if you look on the other side of that T-post there, that's a representation of what everything that we're going to walk through today looked like, 12 or more years ago out here. I mean, everything was covered in yellow star thistle. And while we still got yellow star thistle in some areas, and this year was really challenging because of the rain, a lot of yellow star thistle came back in. But like, this whole thing was covered in it, and now we've got a nice mix of native grasses brought in, and we're starting to experiment with some other ways of dealing with star thistle as it starts to come in, such as mowing, windrowing the star thistle, burning the windrows, you know, trying to create some different intensities around it to shift it. But this is kind of an experimental plot here, so we like to, you know, use this as a way to demonstrate to people, like, here's how you do it.
Right here. So star thistle right here, and then there's this other grass just past it.
Yeah,
so what's the difference in management?
Yeah, so that's all burned. Everything up at this end has had fire, particularly that strip there. I wasn't here when they did the burn. I was actually in North Carolina at a fire conference when they did the burn, so I didn't get to see it until about 2 weeks after, and things it's already started to kind of erase in terms of what you would see as the fire scars. But the star thistle, probably, I'm guessing why this area has so much star thistle from this year is that area probably burned a little bit hotter, and this year this area burned a little bit cooler, and they might have been doing a backing fire from here, and then it hit some material that was down there that allowed for it to burn hotter. That's just speculation on my part, but I'm guessing that's probably what created that.
We've heard today that if you don't burn yellow star thistle at the right time,
yeah,
you're not going to get rid of it anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we're not burning it during the summer months, which is what a lot of the research from UC Davis is showing. Like, oh, burn it in July when it starts to flower. We just don't have we don't feel comfortable in doing that in this particular landscape because of being a wildland urban interface. So we burn it in the fall and try to build the heat up, which has been really successful for us.
To knock out the seeds.
Yeah, and so if you can get the intensity enough and with your ignition patterns get that heat, then you're able to knock it back. And where you then have a shift from dominance of star thistle to just having a few star thistles, then it's easy to come in with a weed eater when it starts to flower and hit it then. And that's been our approach on it. One thing I want to point out while we're standing here is, you know, I don't know about you guys. I'm sure most of you guys are thinking about fire a lot, or at least you will be thinking about fire a lot, but that's one thing that everywhere I go, I'm thinking about fire. And so as I think about ignitions and how we've done burns here in the past in this very spot, you know, this little area where it's upslope from us, we've got a transition from pine forest and oak forest and maple into a grassland ecosystem. And I talked about in my presentation how we don't generally do burns out here where we're cutting a lot of line. We're not doing a lot of soil disturbance. And those kind of features, that transition into the oak forest, into the maple forest, are the kind of things that we're using within the landscape to burn to or burn from. So we've got a road here, we've got that shift to maple and the oak over there, and those sorts of things at the right time of year, we don't have to cut line, we can just burn to it or from it, and it's a really light impact on the landscape. I was actually out here November 7th this year with students from Paradise High School talking to them about this very type of fire. We were actually hoping to be able to burn that day, but it was still within the burn ban. But I picked up some of those leaves and I told them, I said, you know, if you understand the system and you are able to, you know, use your hands and your body as an instrument to detect these things, you'll know when is the right time to burn in some of these areas. And I picked up those leaves and they were really soft still. So as it turns out, the relative humidity underneath the maples was about 47% that day. We're out in the middle of this meadow, it was about 20%. And that shift in the relative humidity would have been enough so that I could have burned the grass safely without ever having to cut line, even on a day when we hadn't had rain in months, right? So really important to know your landscape, know the fuels that you're burning, and how fire is going to move in those particular systems. Yeah, Susie?
How much preparation do you do right before you burn, or if it's in an area that you're used to doing, do you know which plants you're looking for and all that stuff? And are you looking for, like, nests and all that before you actually let off?
Yeah, so most of the time when we're burning is not during the nesting season for birds. So that's not really an issue for us. But in terms of prep work, if we're burning in the drier part of the season, we'll do a lot more prep work with trimmers and everything around it. And we always will have backpack sprayers with us just in case something starts to burn in a way that we don't want it to. But it's not like we're chasing fire or anything like that. I mean, it's always done in a very controlled way.
About bowls or, you know, you'd be out here forever.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're definitely here. Like, and if we burn off, you know, if I was able to burn off today, you'd see the vole trails, you'd see the mice trails. But they just go underground.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll be fine. Yep, and then usually right after a burn, you start to see a lot of gopher mounds start to push up, and so you can always see that, you know, that kind of relationship in it. So it's not that big of an impact on them. Yeah.
Earlier, when you were talking about this area, you said fire or surrogates of fire.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Mowing.
Just mowing.
Mowing is what we're doing.
Yeah.
We use a bobcat with the brush hog on the front of it, and just kind of come through here. Although this year, after the campfire, we also had 600 some odd goats that were out here in some areas, so that was also another part of it. You know, so if you have that resource and ability, you know, you can use the goats as a surrogate. But if you're thinking about goats, say, in a wooded environment, the goats are not going to reduce the woody fuel, right? They'll eat the herbaceous and they'll eat some of the shrubs, but the sticks, the bigger stuff, yeah, that will be your fuels, that's going to be left behind. So I always like to use fire. You know, that's my tool, right? That's why I'm here talking to you guys about it, right? So let's continue on, though. I don't want to get everybody cold out here.
We don't want everyone to get cold out there. Back in the studio with Allie Metters-Knight. What do you have to add to that, Allie?
You know, I as he's talking about that area, the star thistle and... Yeah. And just the good times for burning. The questioning sometimes that I get a lot that I've encountered talking about traditional land management, which is using fire as a tool, is that there is a lot of fear that habitat and things that are like living in the snaggles of the forest garbage are going to be
right.
Negatively impacted. It's kind of like a very a very overcautious environmentalist who doesn't mm-hmm. want anything to die in the reset button that fire does to the ecology in a very healthy way. So I've always tried to to figure out and listen to John Hankins and other folks who are teaching and giving presentations on fire, how to handle highly sensitive folks who are have a lot of fear of fire and have a lot of fear of things happening that are out of their control. And when in fact what is happening is that there's a lot of forest garbage, it's all snaggled, it's under, it's way out of control, and it needs management. So it's, I almost compare it to a like a hoovering stage mom who's very concerned about her very overly bratty child getting their feelings hurt when it's absolutely necessary to give them a little bit of the real world, you know.
That's a good way to look at it.
That's how I kind of I view it. Yeah, or I'm like, come on, you need a let some of this go, and then it goes into that, you know, some traditional knowledge also makes sense. So when you're doing fire during the cooler times, when there has been a little bit less, you know, when there's going to be a little bit more moisture in the morning and the day, like good fire times, you are looking at times when the birds are migrating to warmer areas so that they're not nesting. So this is the ideal time to burn and do these things. And so some of it is just wraps up into common sense.
Yeah, and then the common sense, you know, the whole propaganda, because it was going back to your Smokey the Bear earlier in the show. It's really, really depressing in a way, but, you know, you got to kind of put these things out there. But, you know, as the U.S. government and, you know, they're like Smokey the Bear, look at him, he's smoking, we don't want this poor thing to burn, let's make sure we don't do fire. They're napalming in Vietnam, right? There you go.
Yep.
So, you know, be just right up front about that. So what's coming up next is we've got a couple more pieces with Don Hankins, and I'm going to stop and do a really as much of a poignant interview I need to do for my dear friend Stephen Ross Brannon, who's going to kind of be leading us through a couple of these segments here in just a couple of minutes. And People Powered Radio.
And do you have blackberries a lot? This is a riparian corridor here, so
yeah.
Have you had to deal with those, and have you had good luck with it?
So we don't have a lot of Himalaya blackberry out here. I mean, there's patches of it down along the riparian corridor, but generally we're kind of fortunate because we have a lot of the native blackberries that are also out here. Himalaya blackberry is tricky because it, you know, it reproduces vegetatively as well. So and this is for my dissertation research, I studied fire and riparian ecosystems, and a lot of them are heavily invaded with this, right? So if you can burn it and then expose the you know, kind of where the crown is at for it, then pull that out and try to pull the rhizomes out, that's really the best bet. Fire can help to keep it at bay, but it's not going to get rid of it, right? And I think with all of these invasives, I don't expect to ever see 100%, you know, free of invasive species landscape. But I think if we can keep them in some kind of a managed state, then that's our best bet, I think.
And fire is a tool.
Fire is one of the
tools.
Yeah. Yeah. And for those of you who are dealing with Himalaya blackberry on your properties, the asphalt burners, the weed torches, work really well for burning them, particularly when everything else is wet and green around them. So
like
just
right
to, now is a great time to do that. Yeah,
burn them right down to the base.
Just burn them down to the base, and then come in and use them a cloud or hoe or whatever to start pulling it out. Yeah.
You asked some more detailed questions.
My name's John Hunt. I'm with the local land trust.
Oh, nice.
I've been working up in resource up here for 30 years, 25 years. Yeah. So, itinerant biologist formerly.
Yeah.
What's that now?
What lands do you do?
I work for Northern California Regional Land Trust, and we work with private landowners to help them develop agreements for conserving their lands. Particularly, we most frequently work with ranchers and farmers. Those are some of our primary partners, and they have obviously some of they manage some of the key substantive portions of the landscape that are undeveloped.
So this conference is like the Disneyland of conferences for you, then. It's all about private land.
It's certainly germane.
Yeah,
certainly. Yes, and very interesting as well.
Nice talking to you, John Hunt. Thank you.
Likewise.
Any closing comments about your tour here with Don Hankins? This is my first time out in the field with Don. He's a very lively speaker and knowledgeable as well.
Oh, yeah. No, it's incredibly enjoyable. There's been some really good speakers here at the conference. I think next time they could call it some Gardening with Fire.
Gardening with Fire. I like that. Gardening with Fire, back in the studio. Next up is a dear friend of mine, Stephen Ross Brandon, and I talked to him on the phone kind of for about 5 or 10 minutes around the work he's done in our story. And Stephen Ross Brandon, for the last few years, has been a wildland firefighter. But I met Ross, you're listening to the Youth for Justice program, and I met Ross through Youth for Justice. And at that point, Ross was dealing with a heroin addiction. And I came alongside as much as I could, and a lot of people came alongside for our dear, dear friend, Stephen Ross Brandon. You know, the generational solidarity. And he's going to be 2 years sober, clean and sober, in just a couple of weeks. And, you know, if you ever kind of like thinking maybe I shouldn't get involved because you can't make a difference, you can. You really can. And what would you say to that, my dear friend Stephen Marquardt, before we run this?
Yeah, funny thing about meeting on Youth for Justice. That's actually where you and I met, Bill.
That's where I met
in the
Steven.
Studio. And yeah. How about making a difference? The first, you never think, you know, small things are going to take you far until you just try them, because you never know. I offered to help hold the door for Alex Brown when she came up to be interviewed on this studio in November 2018.
That's a cool show, dude.
I didn't do anything on the show. They said, hey, can you
hold
the
door? I didn't either. Yeah, I just sat there.
And
yeah.
Then it turned into me being here in the studio with you once a month, and it's been incredible. So don't doubt those small things that seem mundane. They'll take you far.
Absolutely. And don't doubt that I've learned a ton from Stephen, and hopefully vice versa. But what I learned from Stephen Ross Brandon, he was kind of one of the first people that tuned me into this whole OxyContin scandal of you know, what happened to him and so many other wonderful, beautiful human beings. So with no further ado, I want you to hear my good friend Stephen Ross Brandon here on People Power Radio. My friend Ross Brandon, who is on our Black Friday show on KZFR. And what do you think of this big Chico Creek Ecological Reserve and the conference here today, Ross?
Oh, it's a gorgeous area, you know. I'd say it accurately depicts the ecological diversity out here in the on the valley floor, you know. Shows all the oaks, all the chaparral, and all the random shrubs. I wish that I knew the names of all the species of all the types of oaks a lot better than I do. It's something I'm in the process of learning, but it's just really cool to see where they've burned it, and it's a healthy unit where they've had the star thistle reduced, and you can tell how evident it is right next to a patch that hasn't been burned, how healthy the burning is for it. So
Don mentioned how this is the wildland interface. Maybe you could describe that a little, what that means.
He's saying it's the wildland-urban interface.
Yeah, wildland-urban interface. Thank you, Ross. Yeah. What does that mean?
So the wildland-urban interface is it's referring to rural communities. It's wildland, but people live out here, you know, like Cohasset, small town, like Forest Ranch,
yeah, small town.
Yeah. Exactly. Those are areas that Cal Fire is set up because they want to protect the private property owners. So anytime you're dealing with anything residential, that's urban interface.
Okay. Thank you, Ross Brandon.
Yeah. With the restoration of like the natural or of the native plant species, and I guess somewhat eradication of the non-native species, like what's the effect that it has on the like soil food web and like the insect habitat or just whatever wildlife, like that, I don't know, like does it affect those numbers at all? Like,
well, yeah, it depends on, you know, it all depends on the timing and the type of fire, right? But generally speaking, if you think about it, the wildlife that live in this landscape are all kind of, I'll say, genetically programmed to receive this fire. And so I've seen fire introduced to places where it hasn't been in 100 years, and see some of the animals come out of hibernation to utilize that fire for hunting or, you know, bathing in the ash and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'd say right now we're doing all the work that's pretty much being done is reversing that 100 years of fire suppression.
Right.
Yeah, I was just out up on the Capels. That was interesting. I think that the little bit of rain that they got, they called for season-ending rains in every forest in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know, they were confident they got enough moisture, so it was burning piles and just kind of got out and
right.
had that crazy wind event.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I tend to think, like, we on the reserve ship to piles grapevine. Yeah. We ship to piles during the wettest time of year when we can't broadcast for it anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, and sometimes we don't even bother creating the piles until we've got enough moisture on the ground. And then, you know, we start with a small fire using maybe some pitch wood and build that fire up with pitch wood and then start layering stuff on top of it. And then we end up with a kind of a lower temperature combustion that creates a lot of charcoal that then we can throw back out on the landscape as like a biochar, you know, right on site.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So Don, Ross here, my friend Ross, he's got 2 years as a wildland firefighter. And the first time I met him, that I wanted to connect him with the story. He said from his experience, he needs to bring back traditional indigenous burn practices to the land. What would be your advice for him to kind of champion that and have it happen over the course of his lifetime?
Right. Well, I think, you know, one of the first things I would suggest is to, you know, look for people from the area where that work is taking place to kind of guide that process and bring in his partners on it, right?
Like what we're here right now for.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, shout out for that. You know, that was my funnish visual, the whole thing. I was like, I was doing it. They were laughing in the studio. I was telling them how I was like walking uphill backwards in the rain with a whole bunch of people around me gathering that. But the visual was so beautiful in that. I know Stephen knows more than most because I took in a lot of pictures, and I wish I could have taken a picture of my young friend of Stephen Ross Brannan with Don Hankins. But that was just one of my favorite pieces. And the one thing I want to say, I forgot off the top, is as North Valley Harm Reduction Coalition, we love you, and they're part of my tribe. So if you're going after North Valley Harm Reduction Coalition, you're going after my tribe, and you're going after people like Ross Brannan here, who's turned his life around. So if you're listening to people that are caustic and evil and kind of explaining how those people are horrible, go somewhere else, man, because that's bad energy, man. That's really bad energy. And I think we have an underwriter. What do you got to add to that, Stephen? Give me an underwriter.
Well said. And I want to just say a big thank you, because Youth for Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KCFR supporters and by Advantage Insurance Services. Local independent insurance broker Dave Dalton can provide for all your insurance needs. Advantage Insurance is proud to support KCFR and can be reached at 342-0540. For a quote or more information, visit AdvantageInsuranceChico.com. And by Chico Custom Cabinetry, creating dream kitchens, bathrooms, and more. Chico Custom Cabinetry works with all budgets and offers no charge for consultations or estimates. Licensed and bonded, you'll find them on Facebook at ChicoCustomCabinetry.com or by calling 324-0032. If you can dream it, we can build it.
So the last segment we're going to do before we bring it back into the studio for the last 10 minutes with Ali is perfect way to end it, because I met this gentleman. I spent a lot of time with Andrew Girard. I built a fence with Andrew. I spent a lot of time in space with Andrew during the Eco Restoration Camp, fall camp up in Paradise. And it's a beautiful interview I do with him about why he's there and learning these practices. But I can't say enough for the last pre-record before we turn it into the studio. But you're going to hear from Wolfie, who's doing prescribed burn associations here for the county. And thank you for tuning in, and thank you for supporting People Powered Radio. You're with Andrew Girard from Soul Sanctuary, the host for the Eco Restoration Camp in the fall. And Andrew's out here with me walking the tour with Don Hankins and getting some insights to how to do traditional burns with modern technology. You know, how does that apply to that wonderful property at Soul Sanctuary? Maybe tell our folks a little bit about what the property looks like.
We've got a lot of gray pines, a lot of invasives like star thistle and some Medusa's head, and looking to try and knock that back and reestablish natives, medicines, and really trying to learn more about how to cultivate the native species and sort of create a nursery on our property that can help to repopulate the surrounding areas. Mm-hmm. Really, I came up here because I'm interested in just you know, maybe starting a conversation with my neighbors about fire safe communities and utilizing controlled burns as a tool for just making our community a lot safer. Interested in possibly a burn association.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to Wolfie about that, because Wolfie was from, I don't remember the organization, but I've talked to her before, but that's her thing. She presented on prescribed burn associations and all the benefits of that. I mean, maybe for a landowner like you, what did you hear from her presentation?
I just like the collaborative nature of the idea and just the opportunity to have every member of the communities supporting each other in managing their properties and staying safe and pooling resources, manpower. It's an awesome idea, and hoping to benefit from it.
Any closing comments, Andrew, as we walk uphill with Don Hankins and crew?
Very inspiring here. Very beautiful. And I can definitely see the potential for my own land looking a lot like this.
I'm here with Wolfie Rugel. You can do a short intro, but I'm just curious, as we walk the land with Don Hankins, Wolfie, some of the things you're picking up and how you can expand on how to implement this with a prescribed burn association.
Well, I think what you really take away from walking with Don is that there's so many ways to burn the land, and we're often, you know, on TV, we often see like this one, like very professionalized way where, you know, there's often helicopters and everybody's wearing protective equipment, and that's a way to get a lot of burning done all at once, and the people who do that are really good at what they do. But for individual landowners, it's often really appropriate to be out there by yourself with your family and your friends and neighbors, and if the conditions are right and you know how to read that the conditions are right and you know your land, you can burn in your street clothes. I've seen people do it. Mm-hmm. You know, people know their land and they have common sense, and people aren't gonna, you know, like we were talking about, people aren't gonna go to a workshop and then just go home and light something on fire, you know. For me, certainly, it's gonna take a lot more learning until I'm comfortable burning most of the parts of my land, but you can acquire skills. You know, you can get to, just because I don't know how to do something right now doesn't mean I'll never be able to do it.
So that's a good transition to your role. I know you did a lot of presentations around prescribed burn associations. What is your role in trying to get those started? Administrative, champion, a little bit of both?
That's right. So my position at the Butte County Resource Conservation District is about one quarter of my time is devoted to coordinating the Prescribed Burn Association. So I write grants to try to support the association in the future. I convene meetings. I give presentations like this. Try to find those folks in the community who are already experienced burners or who are just like really invested in becoming more experienced burners. Bring those people together. Figure out what opportunities and resources they think they need to be more successful, and then try to find a way to connect them with those resources.
How do we connect with the work you're doing and your organization's work? Is there a link or something we could plug?
Definitely. You should go to the Butte County Resource Conservation District's website. That's www.bcrcd.org. Under what we do and projects, you can find the Prescribed Burn Association. People can also email me at wolfie@bcrcd.org. That's Wolf with a Y at bcrcd.org.
Thank you, Wolfie.
Yeah, the only thing to add to that before I turn it back over to Allie Meadows Knight is go to that same site she mentioned, and I'm going to look it up as you talk and say it again, but you can find all the materials that were in these prescribed burns on private land. So we got about 5 or 6 minutes, Allie. What do you want to add to what we've just listened to?
You know, I always I want to just give people, you know, the opportunity to share this experience that I had living in Orleans, California, and sitting on a porch with family and friends, and right across, we were on a road called Ishi Pishi Road, and on Ishi Pishi Road, they had done these what they call trex burns, traditional burns, but they were also prescribed burns. Slight difference between the two. Most of it is kind of how Wolfie explained, where it's not like a hard hat operation with a lot of looking like flagging type of fire gear, but traditional burning is more your grandpa, burning the leaves in the ditch around the yard in very casual yard work kind of clothes. So I was able just to see fires burn all the way up the mountain during the night, and having people feel very casual and helpful about it, where there was goats and there was families and there was people. And you could see the fire out of your house window cooking dinner going up the mountain, and you could literally, I could literally go out into the on my porch and actually pick up a rock and hit the fire. That's how close it was. So it was an awesome experience to not fear the fire and have it be a community event, right, where everyone's part of it. And I think that talking to Wolfie, I think Wolfie's excellent part of the community as far as helping people get connected to their resources, especially their funding resources for their mm-hmm. programming. So if people really want to get into some prescribed burning on their private property, I encourage them to go even to the website here of Imagining Communities, get linked up with Wolfie's, the site she has. Right. Go ahead and find those things. Also, additionally, I'm working with the Machupta Indian Tribe. We, in our goal to apply for the 2018 Farm Bill, which is land management federal forest lands, what we're looking at is doing tribal certifications for traditional ecological knowledge. And under that, we also want to do burn management so we can actually give certification as a traditional burning. And so I'm working with Don Hankins. I'm working with Machupta tribal members that have a lot of fire experience, firefighting, but also working with traditional practitioners that will be training extensively on how to do traditional burning here in California. So we are looking into creating those certifications and programs within the next year so that there's actually not only prescribed burning from CAL FIRE in a very technical way, but we can introduce the traditional knowledge inside of that with the tribe, Machupta tribe. I am from the Machupta tribe. There are other tribes here in Butte County that do work on land management. And so hopefully we'll be collaborating with them. I have been doing traditional ecological knowledge and teaching it for 15 years. So my experience is more relative just to Chico, Butte County here in this area between Paradise, Bidwell Park, and whatnot. So we're going to be looking at having Wolfie's working on a program to have our applications for burns to be done here in Bidwell Park along actually there's four locations within the town of Chico that need to have understory burns. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we would be able to bring into a possibility for the tribe to respond to an RFP to contract to do traditional ecological knowledge, not only for burning, but for restoration using native plants.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, I just wanted to say something real fast. I was there. We did a meet and greet for Imagining Community. That's at Imagining Community. And real quick before I read this is I've just been so blessed. You know, we've been covering this story an extra month for this story. We started it in December, but we're going to be covering the traditional ecological knowledge, Native American culture, Native American genocide for 3 months. But I have this quote. I said this to my dear friend here, Stephen, around a table with some beautiful people at this meet and greet. I said, isn't it so cool how many cool people we meet? And as a radio producer, a lot of times we just don't land on the humanity. So I sent this to Allie just before at the new year. So real quick, I said, I so see you and you're amazing. I'm profoundly impressed with the elegance and grace you bring wherever you go and your uncanny ability to be present in the moment for people, irregardless of their beliefs. You're that rare human being whose inner beauty and strength personifies itself in whatever you do. I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled. I know the whole team is. I'm thrilled to be getting to know you as we cover our season one story at Imagining Community.
Oh,
and we got like two more minutes there, Mr. Stephen Marquardt. Take us on out. Take us on out.
So if you're interested in following up with this story and learning more about how you can get involved, I would highly recommend that you come out and join us on January 12th. We're going to be having another documentary showing at Blackbird Cafe, 6 to 7:30 p.m., which is really going to be following the story of how folks have been burning lands and how they are using traditional ecological knowledge for the benefit, and really kind of foreshadowing what's to come in the future from what Allie and her team are pushing forward. And we're going to hopefully hear from some different voices in the community after the showing of that film and really plugging y'all in. And so it should be a lot of fun. I hope people can make it. It's going to be at Blackbird on January 12th. 6 to 7:30 p.m. Go ahead and check out our website or Facebook. We'll have details about that event. But it's going to be one of a few ways that you can get plugged into this story, because that is a really big hope of this whole project, is to engage folks in these stories. It's one thing to tell them and enjoy them, but it's even better to be able to help shape them and turn them into something beautiful. So hope you can join us for that. And Alia, do you have any last words here for people?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. My last words will always be plant seeds. Go find your native seeds.